From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When WikiLeaks released 200,000-some U.S. diplomatic cables, one journalist's name was mentioned more than 400 times. He is Wada Kanfar, news director of the Qatar-based satellite news channel Al Jazeera. Many of the mentions involved diplomatic complaints about Al Jazeera's coverage of the Iraq War and the Middle East in general, which coverage the U.S. government has often regarded as populistic to the point of inflammatory. Here's how Wada Kanfar explained Al Jazeera's perspective to us last year.
The amount of commitment that our audience have towards Al Jazeera, they embrace us, not because we are politically correct from the point of view of governments, which most of them are authoritarian. No, we are full of pride and determination because the public think of Al Jazeera as their own.
But the WikiLeaks revelation this week was of a very different sort, antagonizing not the United States government, but Qatar's. And Kanfar is no longer running Al Jazeera. The reason? Possibly the emergence of one particular WikiLeak, a 2005 cable from U.S. Ambassador to Qatar, Chase Untermyer, suggesting that Kanfar had softened coverage of the Iraq invasion under pressure from the United States and Qatar, whose royal family funds Al Jazeera. Kanfar has been replaced by Sheikh Ahmad bin Yassim bin Mohammed Al Thani, a member of the Qatari royal family. Lawrence Pintack is a longtime Middle East correspondent and author of The New Arab Journalist, Mission and Identity in a Time of Turmoil. Lawrence, welcome back to On the Media.
My pleasure.
Wada Kanfar steps down. Kind of a jaw-dropping development, no?
This man is the figure, the most influential figure in Arab journalism, and certainly one of the most influential figures in global journalism. For the last 8 years, he has piloted Al Jazeera to be the news organization that everyone turns to, whether they like it or not. And with the launch of Al Jazeera English a decade ago, that influences people around the world.
Influential, powerful, but not without controversy.
Well, he's certainly a very controversial figure. There are many in the newsroom who've complained about what they see as his pro-Hamas proclivities. Many see that playing out on the air at Jazeera, and that has brought him into conflict with his Qatari masters at times. Many would argue with very good reason.
Now, let's get to the case at hand here. The revelation through WikiLeaks that in the wake of complaints from the Americans, Al Jazeera removed some of what the Americans considered to be inflammatory images. This revelation appears, and next thing you know, he is out the door. What are we to make of that?
We only have circumstantial evidence that there's a direct connection between those cables and his resignation. The pressures he was facing from his own government, the Qatari government, not to completely alienate the Americans, while at the same time trying to provide a pretty drastically different view of the war, meant that he was playing both sides against the middle automatically. If he was ousted, I would bet $1,000 that it was not over these WikiLeaks cables, because ultimately all he was shown doing in these WikiLeaks cables is what the Qatari government wanted him to do, placate the Americans. If, in fact, he was fired as a result of it, it was simply an excuse to get rid of him.
Al Jazeera has been way out in front of everybody else on Tunisia and Syria and Libya and Egypt, but in its own backyard, neighboring Bahrain, not so much. And the question is, to what extent do the Qatari royals have on the way Al Jazeera is covering or not covering democratic protests in neighboring Bahrain?
There have been a lot of rumblings in the newsroom about the fact that the Qatar government has been the prime sponsor for the Libyan opposition. Jazeera's coverage has been all Libya all the time. And at the same time, the coverage of Bahrain has been, shall we say, limited in the extreme, or as someone in the newsroom said to me, too balanced. It's known in the newsroom, people around him, that Kanfar has been uncomfortable with both of these extremes.
One more thing, and it concerns Al Jazeera's reputation and credibility with its audiences in the Arab world. Where does it stand in the wake of these episodes on the Arab street and in the halls of Arab power?
On the street, it's very popular in countries where there are revolutions. In the halls of power, not so much. There is a great deal of angst about the direction Jazeera has driven the region. Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, one of the richest men in the world, recently announced the launch of Al-Arab, another all-news channel that will more directly reflect the views of those in the halls of power, to drive the Saudi viewpoint across the region. And Jazeera is not taking that lightly. So this change of leadership could be a preemptive move to try to counter Saudi Arabia's play at regaining the upper hand in Arab media.
Dean Pintack, thank you very much.
My pleasure, anytime.
Lawrence Pintack is the dean of the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication at Washington State University and author of The New Arab Journalist, Mission and Identity in a Time of Turmoil.
Last week, the mutilated bodies of a man and a woman were found dangling from a pedestrian overpass in the Mexican border town of Nuevo Laredo. Discovered with the bodies were two notes explicitly warning that those who post the wrong things online will share the same fate. It's unclear if the authorities have identified the bodies, but the message is clear. The cartels are on to social media and their new role as information aggregators in Mexico's drug wars. For years, reporters who dared touch the cartels were threatened and killed. Last year, after a photographer for the leading Ciudad Juarez newspaper El Diario was killed in his car for getting too close to the drug war. After that, editor Gerardo Rodriguez wrote a front-page editorial titled, "What Do You Want From Us?" pleading for, quote, "a truce because we don't want them to kill any more of our compañeros." Here's what he told us.
We recognize that they are the authority in town because the authorities are non-existent. The cartels are not just criminal, you know, sometimes they're politicians. We're recognizing this fact, which everybody talks about in Mexico, but is not published very often.
Recently, blogs and Twitter feeds have rushed in to fill the information void, hence the murders last week. Luis Navarre has written on the subject for New America Media and joins us from Merida, Mexico. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
As you heard, the El Diario editor had issued a cry of the heart. So where has that left the coverage of the cartels?
What the editor in Ciudad Juarez was talking about was the phenomenon of the cartels and their ability to intimidate traditional media, which has in many parts of Mexico, if not most of the country, basically relinquishes authority and just doesn't cover the drug wars. They cover violence. So many bodies were found here. This incident happened there. But they don't do investigative reporting in the sense that they go out there and try to figure out what's going on.
Now, since social media allows for greater anonymity, it's been able to fill some of that gap in coverage, right?
Right, because what's emerging is that people are in some ways inspired by the Arab Spring or other phenomena throughout the world where people can communicate effectively through Twitter and Facebook to inform and rat out drug cartels and their activities by posting messages such as, there's a suspicious activity in this house that's suspected of being a safe house. And with these kinds of messages that are being aggregated through Twitter and other forms of social media, the authorities are actually being able to get intelligence. And you're seeing it along the border, and you're seeing it in Monterrey, in Veracruz. You know, if there are 60 postings about a suspicious house in this neighborhood, then that gives the authorities and intelligence officials an idea of what areas are being used as safe houses or things of that nature. And so basically, unlike other areas of the world where social media is used to organize against a government, which is what we've seen all year in the Middle East, here people are actually using the social media to defend the principle of government rule.
So the cartel wants the public to assume that the bodies of the man and the woman hanging from the bridge last week were bloggers or users of social media. Has there been a reaction online to this gruesome attack?
There really has been no change. In fact, there's been an increase in social media chatter since it happened. and people being very, very defiant about it, saying, we're taking back our country, this is our country, and we're taking it back from the narcos, and we're not going to stop posting online. I mean, it's easy to intimidate a reporter or a public official, but how do you intimidate 35 million people who are online and can just post anonymously anything that they want to? The only way that this is going to stop, I think, is if the cartels figure out a way of bringing down the internet in Mexico and paralyzing Twitter or Facebook, perhaps with dedicated server attacks or some other technological means. But as long as anybody can post on Twitter, it just shows you how technology and how civic participation can change the dynamics of a situation. I mean, here, for example, 11 years ago, Mexico was a one-party country. And now, if you had told somebody 11 years ago that in 2011, the president of the country would be from one party, most of the governors would be from a different party, and the mayor of Mexico City would be from a third party, they would have laughed, saying, that's crazy. Democracy has become rooted in this country in very interesting ways.
Are you suggesting that social media has led to a more genuine and functional democracy in Mexico?
Or I think that a more rigorous democracy in Mexico has empowered social media so that when the newspaper reporters, television reporters are a little bit intimidated, the civic body itself is prepared to step in and pick up the flag.
Luis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Luis Navarre writes for New America Media.
Coming up, the state of Palestinian statehood.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, offering local seminars for email marketing and social media. Learn more at ConstantContact.com/local. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at WallaceFoundation.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, when Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas announced that he would press the UN General Assembly for statehood, President Obama found himself pressed between two immovable objects. On one side, Israel, and more importantly, the powerful pro-Israel lobby urging him to veto the measure. On the other members of the Security Council, most of the European Union, and the entire Arab world, all supporting the Palestinian bid. In his speech Wednesday to the UN, Obama threw his weight behind the Israeli government's position.
Peace will not come through statements and resolutions at the United Nations. If it were that easy, it would have been accomplished by now.
On Friday, Abbas resisted pressure from the United States and submitted his formal request for Palestinian statehood. Now the measure will be taken up by the 15-member Security Council. In order to pass, the vote would require support from 9 of those members. But even if the Palestinians manage to get those 9 yes votes, Obama's veto is a foregone conclusion. Why? In June of 2010, in a much-discussed essay in the New York Review of Books called The Failure of the American Jewish Establishment, journalist Peter Beinart argued that groups like the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, the Anti-Defamation League, and the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations all squelch criticism on these shores by depicting all of Israel's critics as Israel's enemies.
Just before Beinart's essay was published, we asked him and Stephen Rosen, the former director of foreign policy issues at AIPAC, to debate the issue. The focus was intentionally narrow. This was not a discussion of Israel's right to exist. Both Beinart and Rosen are Zionists. This was a debate about whether criticism endangers Israel's security. More fundamental for this program, it was an argument over whether honest debate ever poses a danger to democracy. Beinart and Rosen did agree on 2 points. First, that criticism of Israel in American media is far more abundant than it used to be. And second, that criticism of Israel in the U.S. Congress is very rarely heard. Mostly I stayed out of it. Peter Beinart begins.
Not to single out AIPAC, but all of the major pro-Israel organizations say very explicitly that their support for Israel, their love of Israel, is not only because they are Jews and Israel is a Jewish state, but because Jews have created in Israel a liberal, democratic Jewish state. But if you say that's why you admire Israel, then it seems to me you have a responsibility to fight for those values, for Israel as a liberal democracy. And I think there are forces in Israel today, in the settlement movement, in Shas, the ultra-Orthodox Mizrahi party, that are hostile to liberal democratic values. And I think we who love Israel as a liberal democracy have to defend them.
But the problem here is there's only one actual Israel. When a person says, I'm pro-Israel, but I don't like the Israel that exists, there's this Israel in my mind that if only they would do all of the things that I say they should do, and then I will love them, they're talking about an imaginary world. There's an actual Israel, the only Israel. And that Israel is surrounded by enemies. And you're either going to try to help protect it, or you're going to jump on the bandwagon of those who are trying to harm it. There's only two camps here. And it's true that you could go to Israel and try to meet with the members of the Israeli government and persuade them to pursue the course of action that you think is appropriate. But you're arguing that that debate should be held in the United States Congress. The United States is Israel's only reliable ally. When you drive a wedge between the United States and Israel, you're weakening Israel. You're causing Israel profound harm.
I think it's mistaken to draw a bright line between Israelis who criticize their government and people outside the United States, particularly Jews. Because, in fact, I think the fate of those Israelis who want to create an open space for criticism is very dependent on our willingness outside of Israel to amplify their voices and be in solidarity with them. In fact, one of the things that worries me most about what this Israeli government has done is their campaign against human rights organizations and others that support criticism and an unvarnished look at Israelis' policies. We have a vice prime minister who called Peace Now, the anti-occupation group, a virus. We've had members of the Knesset, of the ruling parties, that have virtually called the New Israel Fund, and that funds a lot of Israeli human rights organizations, treasonous. Those people need our aid. They need our defense. If I don't have the right, as an American Jew, to amplify the voices of those Israeli Jews who share my values, then I think the fate of those Israeli Jews who want to create space in their society for criticism will be more imperiled. And I believe that I have that right, just as American Jews had the right to be critical of the Soviet Union when it was not allowing Jews to immigrate, just as American Jews had the right to protest about the genocide in Bosnia and that they do in Darfur. I see us, to some degree, all as part of a moral community in which we can have public concerns outside of our borders.
Well, I don't think this is a debate I can win to the NPR audience, but I never said, Peter, that you don't have the right to support the New Israel Fund, for example. If you want to send a contribution to the New Israel Fund, by all means do so. If you want to join an Israeli political party or write in an Israeli newspaper or even an American newspaper, go ahead. But if your point is that AIPAC and the Anti-Defamation League should join the crusade against Israel, which is the central point of your article, then I think you're on the wrong track because they are part of the effort to strengthen Israel and to help Israel in a dangerous world. This is not about debates on university campuses. This is about the survival of Israel against an enormous coalition. You know, American even-handedness is not even-handed in its effects. The whole world is an automatic ally of the other side. Israel has one reliable ally. It's the United States. And when you erode the alliance between the United States and Israel, you're undermining Israel's security. It's not just about the policy you don't like. It's about the whole country, the stuff you do like and don't like equally. So it's the wrong approach. It's like sacrificing your child because they're drinking too much.
I see in what Stephen is saying a reflection partly of the generational divide that I was talking about in my piece, and I say this with great respect, but I just do not identify with this vision that he seems to have in which the entire world is destined to hate Israel and Jews regardless of what Israel does, that it's basically somehow just in the soil, that we should assume that everybody who criticizes Israel, particularly every non-Jew, is doing so from a position of ill will. There's a bleakness, a pessimism to that, that I think is not in what I think of as the best Jewish traditions that animate animate me and my life. Many people who criticize Israel, they believe, understandably, in a post-colonial world, that it is not just to keep control of large numbers of people who you don't give the right to vote. Rather than seeing those people as eternally hostile to Jews and Israel, we should be willing to listen to their criticisms. But the blanket assertion that everybody hates Israel and everybody always will, I think, is part of a bunker mentality that is making it harder for Israel to live out its best traditions.
Perhaps you haven't paid attention that in the last 25 years, since this older generation has faded, you've seen the growth of Islamic extremism on a global scale, much of it aimed at Israel. And they are not so much interested in the territories as such. They are interested in the very existence of Israel, as they openly state. So I don't see how you can dismiss the sea of hostility. It's in front of your face every day. It's not the professors at the Sorbonne, and it's not the New York Review of Books that we're talking about. It's Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran and Syria and Islamic extremists from one end of the globe to the other. So you're talking about a very deeply threatened country. It's not threatened because of one policy or another or the personality of Bibi Netanyahu or any other single thing. The pro-Israel organizations, I worked for one, AIPAC, for 23 years, I ought to know, see themselves as part of an activist effort to fight against that tidal wave.
If criticism lends support and comfort to Hezbollah and Hamas, does that mean that criticism itself becomes an existential issue?
I didn't argue once, Brooke, in this discussion against criticism. What I argued against repeatedly.
Policies in the U.S. government, I understand that.
Exactly.
But you also did say that there are really only two sides. You're either supporting Israel or you've joined the caravan of people who are against them.
Well, it is true that when you write an article like Peter's, which just piles on criticism and barely mentions the threats to Israel, it hardly mentions Hamas, Iran, the world consists, as he tells it, of Israeli sins, which he recites very passionately. He's extremely eloquent. May there be intellectual merit in point number 7 or point number 11? Probably here and there, yeah. But you're not building Zionism, as he says in his article, you're eroding it. Does it mean that you don't have the right in a democracy to say these things? No. But you don't have the right to call it pro-Israel activity. That it is not. And people who say their friends have to be there on a rainy day, not just on a sunny day, not just if Israel does everything perfectly and lives up to your golden shining Israel on the hill in your imagination, but on days when Israel's imperfect, you have to be there. And if you're not going to be there when the going gets rough, then don't call yourself a friend.
I can be there if I believe that Israel is badly hurting itself, just like I had the right to be there when I thought the United States was badly hurting itself during much of the Bush-Cheney period. You can say that I'm a utopian to believe that Israel should not be in the business of creating a situation in which 80% of the people in Gaza are in food aid, that it's utopian to believe that Israel can be secure. I don't believe that's utopian. If that's utopian, then the people who created the state of Israel were utopian, because that was not the vision that they had of what the Jewish state would be, and I don't believe that it's the vision that we have to settle for today.
I don't hear you talking about Israel facing a security dilemma, the dilemma of 3,000 rockets and the danger that far more potent and more accurate and larger warheads will get there that will threaten Israel's major cities. I don't think just filling the airwaves with more criticism of Israel contributes one thing. By the way, a point that I didn't make earlier, you talk about people whose voices are silenced. At the typical American university, a friend of Israel will find it very difficult to get tenure in the political science department. A friend of Israel is looked at someone suspect outside the community of values. And in any place where the intellectual elites congregate, friendship toward Israel is not well regarded. The real imbalance is an unwillingness to hear the pro-Israel voice. That's the real problem.
But Steve, the problem is you're defining pro-Israel as only people who won't be publicly critical. I think you are self-perpetuating this cycle of victimology, everybody is against us, by not being generous in your interpretation of those people who genuinely do want Israel to exist, indeed even thrive and prosper as a Jewish state, but believe its own policies are harmful in that effort. By your definition, I also am part of this sea of people who are anti-Israel. Israel, that just has no meaning for me, given the connection to Israel that I feel and that I plan to instill in my children. It's kind of insulting.
Stephen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Stephen Rosen is director of the Washington Project at the Middle East Forum, a think tank in Washington, D.C. And Peter Beinart, thank you, too.
Thank you.
Peter Beinart is an author, most recently of The Icarus Syndrome, A History of American Hubris. His essay, The Failure of the American Jewish Establishment, is in the June 10th issue of the New York Review of Books. Our website this week is devoted to hacking and hackers, but we don't want to leave out our non-digital listeners. This concerns you too. So, listen on.
Last month, Hurricane Irene reminded us that nothing excites cable news like a big storm.
This thing could be anywhere as a Category 2, 100-mile-per-hour storm.
Preparations underway in Virginia ahead of the monster storm.
Possibly a Category 4 hurricane in the northern Bahamas.
But hurricanes aren't the only storms that sweep across our landscape. There are also destructive storms on the Internet. That's where the Internet Storm Center comes in. This elite group of uber geeks monitors their monitors 24/7 on the lookout for dangerous viruses, insidious worms, and relentless bots, lest they make landfall on your computer or on somebody else's that really matters, like the bank or the army. Alan Powler, Director of Research at SANS Institute, the home of the Internet Storm Center. What is the Internet Storm Center, after all?
It's a collection of people and sensors. Sensors that are watching for traffic that is unexpected, so that when a spike happens, we pick it up and say, wow, that might be a new worm. The other side is a group of volunteers called handlers, full-time employees of large organizations or small organizations who 24 hours a day are on duty to respond when somebody finds something really bad on their computer. They'll put a notice out to the 200,000 people who are part of the SANS community, and they can find out within a few hours whether there's a lot of it or a little of it.
Is there any way for you to describe in plain English what a typical threat might be like and how the storm center reacts?
A simple example is a program that makes a file, like a music file, and when you open it, the file may play the music, but in addition to playing the music, it also takes over your computer so that whenever that malicious person wants to, he can use your computer to attack other computers or to send out spam or to look for data about you or your company. We find that software and we take it apart, and then we write programs that will find it and get rid of it.
And you're doing this all of your own volition, right? Aren't there official organizations that are doing similar things just as an ordinary course of business?
What's different about the Storm Center is it responds immediately. When things go to any of those organizations, in general, unless you're paying a lot of money to them, you don't get anything back for a month or two. When you send something into Storm Center, you'll hear something about it the next morning. Think of us as the emergency room and them as more the deeper hospital services.
If I were a Hollywood screenwriter, I would be doing a story about a group exactly like yours, infiltrated by some malign individual, hell-bent on undermining the world's computers by essentially being a worm in your organization and going out from there.
A few years ago, one of our people worked undercover for the Naval Criminal Investigative Service and found that the worst of the hackers who were doing malicious things at night in the Boston area was during the daytime the chief security officer for a Boston company. There's a risk for any organization that is trusted that they might distribute a piece of code that people think is going to just look for something when it actually does something malicious. This is a problem, but whenever we distribute a piece of code, it gets vetted through a whole bunch of people.
Tell me, Alan, how does this movie end? Are you ever vigilant and ever successful, or does something catastrophic slip through with who knows what toll?
It ends with a pair of scenes. The first one is the catastrophic attack, because once something catastrophic happens, a whole lot of people who didn't think it mattered much change their mind. And then there's a radical shift, interestingly, that will put us out of business for the most part. what we have been trying to do for almost 20 years is get the people who manufacture software and hardware to manufacture it with security baked in. Right now, it's impossible to keep systems perfectly secure. That's because the people who manufacture it with a bunch of holes in it.
And the manufacturers of software do this. Why?
The answer is fascinating. The colleges teach people how to write programs, but don't teach them how to write them securely. The companies that hire the programmers allow them to write programs, but never test them to make sure that they're writing them securely. We can't get the schools to start teaching this stuff until somebody says, shoot, I'm not going to hire a programmer who can't write secure code. It would be like hiring a pilot who doesn't know how to fly in a storm.
So now I know how your volunteers are organized. Why do they do it? If they're not getting paid, what's in it for them?
Because they want to be part of the solution, and they like the idea of doing that in an organization that has a big impact rather than one where they're just impacting their own organization. And for personal pride, when you're chosen to be an Internet Storm Center handler and you wear the leather jacket that you get when you've been doing it for a year, people notice, they talk to you.
Wait. You really get a leather jacket?
Oh, yeah. They don't get paid anything, so a leather jacket
Spurs,
is a...
Spurs, chaps, badge, gun, what?
Just a leather jacket.
Alan, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Alan Paller is Director of Research for SANS Institute, which is the organizing body of the Internet Storm Center. Coming up, we hear a lot about hacking, but is the hacking we hear about really hacking?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. And I'm going to pull in OTM producer Alex Goldman for a second. Earlier, Brooke mentioned that the website is full of hacker-related yummy deliciousness. Alex, you've been in charge. What do you got, baby?
Yeah, we've got stories about the history of hacking from ancient history to present day. We've got a story on the cultural resonance of the movie War Games. We've got an interview with the editor of the Hacker's Dictionary. We discuss hardware hacking and 3D printing. We even have a story from Radiolab's Sean Cole about the history of phone phreaking, which is to telephones what hacking is to computers. And we've got a whole lot more. So just go to onthemedia.org and click on blog at the top of the screen.
Click on blog, will do. Alex, thanks. I guess we'll hear from you in a couple minutes.
Yep. See you soon.
An anti-hacking law called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act has been on the books since 1986. But when non-technical legislators get into a technical subject, well, they can really screw things up. Marsha Hoffman is a senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Marsha, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So first of all, tell me a little bit about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
The way that the law is written, it is illegal to intentionally access a computer without authorization or to exceed authorized access to that computer and thereby obtain information from any protected computer. And over the years, it's been amended several times. And at this point, there are certain parts of it that are written so broadly that it's actually really unclear what kind of behavior that law targets.
So that's the screw up. What specifically is confusing?
Obtaining information can be something as minor as just looking at it. There have been several cases where an employee does something that is thought to be disloyal. Perhaps the employee decides to leave and start a competing business or what have you. And at that point, the employer tries to sue the former employee under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, claiming that once the employee had a disloyal frame of mind, then access to the employer's computers becomes unauthorized.
The very fact that having thought about leaving the company makes them liable to prosecution under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act? Has a case like that ever been tried?
Absolutely. You know, to give you an example, there was a case in which an individual was working for an employer, and in the course of his work, he emailed himself some documents that were associated with his work, which he was authorized to do. And then at some point, he decided that he was going to leave and start a competing business. And his former employer sued him and said, when you emailed yourself those things, then at that point, that was unauthorized access. You violated the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. The court basically said, well, that can't be a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act because he was allowed to do that in the course of his work. The employer can't decide after the fact that something is unauthorized just because subsequent events happen that the employer doesn't like.
But there have also been cases where the courts have stated that people who delete information off of their work computers while still authorized to use them are in violation of the act. There was a case recently involving a consultant at the accounting firm Deloitte & Touche.
In that particular case, the employee decided to leave his job. And before he returned his work computer to his employer, he destroyed the hard disk. And, you know, what the former employee said was that there had been some personal information stored on there that he didn't want the employer to have, and that he had returned all of the important work-related documents already. Deloitte & Touche alleged that he violated this provision of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act that says that it's illegal to knowingly cause the transmission of a program information code or command that intentionally causes damage to a computer. The court really got that case wrong because this provision of the act, I think, is pretty clearly targeted at sending some sort of an electronic transmission to a computer that causes damage, not physically destroying a hard drive.
What's the difference, really? I mean, we only have the employee's word for it that what he was destroying was his personal data.
You know, that's absolutely true. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that the employee might not have done something that could be punishable. Perhaps the employee destroyed property. There's a different law for that. But we're talking about a law that has both civil and criminal penalties. And the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act has some pretty harsh penalties. Provisions of the law can land you in prison up to 20 years. Certainly, this is not a criminal prosecution here. It's a civil case. But that's part of the problem with this law is that because it is both civil and criminal, when you have these employer-employee disputes that create certain precedents in the law, those are then precedents that could be available to the government to make a case against a criminal defendant.
When we review the record of how the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act has been applied, we find that it was used to sue a union that urged its members to email their employer repeatedly, thus crashing the servers. In another case, Lori Drew created a fake MySpace profile to harass a neighborhood child, and that child ended up committing suicide, was also charged for unauthorized use of a computer for violating the MySpace terms of service under this act. So what you have are a bunch of people who are doing illegal things for which there are no other laws under which they could be charged. This seems like the RICO Act of computer prosecutions to get people who otherwise could evade charges, no?
The important thing is for Congress to decide what behavior it is that we want to penalize and make that behavior illegal. You know, one of the hallmarks of our criminal justice system is that people know what behavior is illegal. And in some of these situations, they may or may not know what behavior is illegal. And if they don't have notice, then you're talking about a potentially unconstitutional law. There was a case just a few months ago in which a former employee of a business sued her employer for wrongful termination. She believed that she was fired from her job because she became pregnant. And her former employer turned around and sued her, claiming that she violated the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act because she spent too much time at work using her computer to check her email and Facebook and do some personal surfing around.
That's computer fraud and abuse?
Thankfully, the court said that is just too much. But I think that is the risk here. Luckily, Congress is starting to recognize that this is a problem. just recently, in the past few days, a bipartisan coalition of senators amended some pending legislation to add a provision that would make clear that it's not illegal to violate terms of use or an acceptable use policy, at least under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Marcia, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Marcia Hoffman is a senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We've been talking about hacks and hackers, but do we really know what hacking means? OTM producer Alex Goldman says, probably not.
It seems like over the past couple of years, we are constantly hearing stories about high-profile hacks.
A British tabloid is being accused tonight of going much too far to get a story. Mark Phillips reports the newspaper hacked into the phone messages of a missing 13-year-old girl.
Guessing voicemail passwords? Not really a hack.
Supporters of the whistleblowing website and its controversial founder, Julian Assange, are targeting government and private websites that have taken action against WikiLeaks.
Denial of service attack on a website? Not a hack either.
A Tennessee college student has been indicted for allegedly hacking into the private email account of Alaska Governor Sarah Palin.
That college student made an educated guess at Palin's password. Sorry, not a hack. Fast Company's Adam Pennenberg wrote that journalists use the word hack as lazy shorthand and because it sounds so cool.
I can tell you, talking to people when they say, I was hacked, there's almost like a secret joy in it. I was important enough to have someone try to penetrate my systems. I was hacked. A lot of these hacks happen to be denial of service attacks. It's like having a million people call the same phone number and all you're going to get is a busy signal. Is that really a hack? Is the fact that News of the World access people's voicemails illegally, is it a hack when all they really did was guess people's passwords or find a really simple way around the voicemail security?
So then what is hacking? Let's trace the term back about five decades to a student club at MIT called the Tech Model Railroad Club. Stephen Levy, author of Hackers, Heroes of the Computer Revolution.
The people who were working underneath the table, where on top of the table there was a very elaborate train layout, called themselves hackers because they hacked away this very complicated system that ran the trains in a very sophisticated manner. Hacking meant fiddling around with technology in sort of an irreverent and makeshift way.
Previously, MIT students had used the word hack as slang for prank. Combining its roots in pranking and its use by the Tech Model Railroad Club pretty much encompasses what it means today. This original set of hackers happened to take the first undergraduate computing course at MIT, exploring these enormous, expensive, new toys literally around the clock. From this culture, a set of moral imperatives which Levy has dubbed the hacker ethic began to emerge.
Things that people thought that you couldn't and shouldn't do on computer, those are the things the hackers wanted to do. Hackers basically believe that all information should be free, that anything that keeps you away from information should be surmounted.
As university computers began to connect to one another in the late 60s, so did the hacker. In 1975, a glossary of hacker terms was created called the Jargon File, proliferating hacker ideas and ideals. The term hacker expanded to include those who created open-source software, specifically designed to be shared and improved upon. Hackers began to explore other people's computers, too, sometimes with questionable legality. By 1983, with the release of the blockbuster movie War Games,
shall we play a game?
Popular culture had already hammered out a stereotypical notion of what a hacker is. Smart, alienated, prone to illegal activity, and borderline autistic.
Wow, where'd you get this?
I was trying to break into Protovision. I wanted to see the program for their new games.
Hey, wait, Jim, I'm not through yet.
Remember you told me to tell you when you were acting rudely and insensitively? Remember that? You're doing it right now.
War Games, about a teenager who hacks into a military supercomputer, triggering a nuclear panic, forever tainted the word hacker, even though it's never actually uttered in the film. 2 months after the release of the movie, the FBI raided a group of teenage hackers called the 414s. Named for their Milwaukee area code, the 414s broke into a number of high-profile computer systems. Comparisons to War Games were immediate. prompting media coverage like this from CBS's Night Watch.
Well, the effect came a little too close to fiction in Milwaukee recently. Some whiz kids actually managed to dial their way into a computer at a nuclear weapons lab in Los Alamos, New Mexico. The lab says no classified information was compromised. But the question remains, could it really happen?
17-year-old Neil Patrick, self-appointed spokesman for the 414s, testified before Congress in September of 1983 about computer security concerns. Congressman Dan Glickman opened the proceedings by saying, quote, "We're going to show about 4 minutes from the movie War Games, which I think outlines the problem fairly clearly." Within months, a flurry of legislation was introduced specifically targeting this kind of intrusion, and in the public eye, the word hacker became synonymous with criminal. NYU assistant professor Gabriella Coleman says that by the late 80s, hackers started to try to reclaim the word.
Some hackers came up with the term cracker, which was meant to differentiate what a hacker means from a cracker, which is someone who breaks into a system maliciously or with malicious intent or engages in destruction or theft.
The hacker community wanted the media to make a distinction between hackers and crackers, but the distinction never stuck. Partly because every self-respecting hacker has a different definition of the term. For instance, security-conscious hackers will say,
"You know, those free and open-source software developers, those are not hackers, because they're just building and tinkering." I've also heard among free and open-source software hackers who consider any form of transgressive hacking as that which doesn't qualify under the rubric of hacking, because hacking is only constructive. And so there are many times where people will point fingers and say, "Ah, that's not really part of the hacking community."
In the hacker community, hacker has always been something of an honorific, a title that cannot be self-proclaimed, only bestowed. If you call yourself a hacker, chances are you're not. Anonymous, the notorious collective of hacktivists implicated in some recent attacks, definitely contains some old-school hackers. But the majority use a pre-existing program called the Low Orbit Ion Cannon to take down websites. The hacker community derisively calls these techno-opportunists script kiddies.
Script kiddie is such a great term to designate those participants, actors who may be engaging in something that looks like hacking, but doing so in the most kind of unthoughtful, unintelligent way, where you're just kind of using a tool to, let's just say, break into a system. It's sort of like a hacker wannabe without the technical skills.
In fact, in recent years, the word hack has been somewhat rehabilitated. Take, for example, Danny O'Brien, the technology journalist who works for the Committee to Protect Journalists. In 2004, he coined the phrase life hacks to describe applying the efficiency and creativity of hacking to things like making tea or setting your alarm clock.
I've been tracking how a lot of geeks seem to be incredibly productive. They all have these little sort of systems for organizing themselves. And so it seemed very sensible to call this life hacks because these were geeky people, they were hackers, and they were sort of applying this semi-scientific, semi-engineering approach to things like, you know, getting out of bed on time, which is something I find impossible.
Which is not to say that the hacker community necessarily appreciated it.
I have a small twinge of guilt because as soon as I coined this term life hacks, it became part of a pattern of the word hacks being over-applied or applied in ways that some people who use it don't necessarily agree with, right? As soon as people started thinking of these things as life hacks, people would post things going, "Oh, I found a new way of tying my shoelaces. I'm hacking my shoes right now."
When you go to Silicon Valley and you talk to startup people, they all talk about, "We want to hire hackers for our company."
Stephen Levy suggests that hack may be regaining its original meaning.
Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook says, "We want this to be a hacker company." You go to Facebook headquarters, there's big signs saying hack. And Facebook isn't breaking into other people's computers. They're talking about coming up with really good products, and those are the kinds of people they want.
I think we already have a more nuanced idea of the word hack compared to this very sort of one or the other idea that we had in the 80s.
Danny O'Brien says it no longer summons up mad scientists or hapless teens.
The word hacker internally in the subculture is incredibly subtle, and I do think that subtlety is gradually beginning to bleed into its use in the mainstream media, too.
But subtlety is not a media strong point. So what does this debate over the word leave us with? A mysterious set of evolving skills and shifting ethics, an annoying feeling of uncertainty, just like how many old media types feel about new media. But the media have to do a better job of distinguishing among actors in this ongoing drama. Otherwise, the only unambiguous hacks will be the reporters themselves. Well, you know what I mean. For On the Media, I'm Alex Goldman.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurkhman, Chris Neary, and Dylan Keefe, with more help from Doug Anderson and Gianna Palmer, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, and you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.